From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the Japanese-born Pokemon craze includes video games, a cartoon series, trading cards, comic books, and a movie that opens today. We'll talk with Gerard Jones, who translates Pokemon comics into English. Our solemn promise, stay tuned and you'll know the difference between a Pokemon and a Pikachu. Also, commentator Maureen Corrigan has some thoughts about Al Gore campaign advisor Naomi Wolf. And we remember jazz trumpeter Lester Bowie, a founder of the Art Ensemble of Chicago. He died earlier this week at age 58. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board released some puzzling information today from the flight data recorder that was recovered yesterday amid the wreckage of Egypt Air Flight 990. Jim Hall said the recorder showed that the plane's flight was uneventful until the autopilot disconnected and it began what appeared to be a controlled descent. He said technicians are still analyzing the final 5 to 10 seconds of information, but that the plane's thrust reverser seems to have had no part in the crash, and it apparently did not fall at supersonic speed. Hall also said that searchers are no longer confused by the sound of a pinger that fell off the flight data recorder and are now concentrating on finding the cockpit voice recorder.
The remote operating vehicle, the Magnum, is continuing to work on the debris pile that has the remaining pinging sound in it. So we have at least gotten to the point that we're not confused by two pingers. We are now working on the one area.
All 217 people aboard the plane were killed when it crashed on October 31st. A judge in Eugene, Oregon, sentenced Kip Kinkle to 111 years in prison today for the murders of his parents and two students at his high school. Kinkle had pleaded guilty to 4 counts of murder and 26 counts of attempted murder stemming from a shooting spree at his high school in May of 1998. Kinkle, who is now 17 years old, agreed to a 25-year sentence for the 4 murders, but the judge added nearly 87 years more on the attempted murder charges. His defense attorney told the court that Kinkle was mentally ill and was driven to commit the murders by hallucinatory voices. Negotiations continue between congressional leaders and the White House on spending bills for the current fiscal year. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Republican leaders say they're getting close to agreements on several key issues that have forced another temporary spending bill some 40 days into the new fiscal year. Progress is reported on a dispute over hiring new teachers. President Clinton wants more than $1 billion to hire an additional 100,000 teachers to reduce classroom sizes. Republicans are insisting local districts be given flexibility in how to spend the money. Still unresolved is a quarrel over an administration request for $1 billion to pay back dues to the United Nations. Republicans want the money tied to a requirement barring international family planning agencies receiving U.S. funds from lobbying foreign governments to overturn their abortion laws. Congress has gone home for the Veterans Day holiday, and GOP leaders hope to have things wrapped up for when lawmakers return to Washington Friday. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 19 points to close at 10,598. Declines led advances by a small margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. At Microsoft's annual shareholders meeting today, company chairman Bill Gates repeated the company's position that it's open to settling the government's antitrust case, but only if the company maintains the right to innovate and design its software. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Seattle.
Bill Gates told shareholders that Microsoft was, quote, willing to go a long way to address government concerns, but added, if we can't add internet features, we can't add any new features. Innovation, he said, is a critical issue, not just for Microsoft, but for the entire industry. Gates defended his company's handling of the government's antitrust case against the software giant. Last Friday, in his findings of fact, a federal district judge sided with the government, ruling that Microsoft is a monopoly that has used its market power to thwart competition and hurt consumers. Asked by a shareholder if the company has talked about alternatives rights should the government order the breakup of Microsoft. Bob Herbold, the company's chief operating officer, said it is premature to discuss anything like that. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
The Senate voted today to increase the criminal penalties for selling powdered cocaine and for selling illegal drugs to minors. The measure passed on a vote of 50 to 49. It would bring the punishment for selling powdered cocaine closer to that for selling crack cocaine. A 1996 anti-drug law called for tougher sentences for drug dealers who sell crack. Civil rights advocates said that law resulted in harsher punishment for blacks, on the theory that black people are more likely to use the cheaper crack cocaine, while whites are more likely to use the more expensive powdered version of the drug. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Catch 'em, catch 'em, gotta catch 'em all.
If you're not the parent or acquaintance of a young child, chances are you may not be familiar with a multimedia, multi-million-dollar fad that's pervading pop culture right now. Pokemon, a slang phrase for pocket monsters, started in Japan and has come to this country in the form of video games, trading cards, a cartoon series, a line of comic books, and, opening today, a feature film. To get some perspective on this phenomenon, we've gone to Gerard Jones, an American writer who is translating the Japanese comic books into English for Viz Comics. Here's some helpful music about the different Pokemon characters.
Kabuto, Persian, Paris, Horsey, Raticate, Magnemite, Weepinbell, Ditto, Cloyster, Caterpie, Sandshrew, Bulbasaur, Charmander, Golem, Pikachu!
At least 100!
Together with the other days of the week.
That's why you can't miss a show.
You gotta catch 'em all!
Catch 'em, catch 'em, gotta catch 'em all. Gotta catch 'em all. Pokemon!
Gerard Jones, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Okay, first of all, what is a Pokemon?
A Pokemon is a little creature, one of 150 some little creatures that were invented for a Game Boy game, and they're all sort of animal-based, or a few of them are object-based, like there's an egg one and a couple of mechanical ones. But they're all cute little things that have no gender, and they live wild in the forest or in the fields, and they are caught and tamed by Pokemon trainers, who tend to be about 11, 12, 13 years old, and turned into gladiators, in effect. And some are very cute, and some are very fierce, and some are very little, some are very big.
And the idea for kids is to collect as many images of these Pokemons as possible. Is that the idea?
There are a lot of different ways kids attack it. Some are very into the Game Boy, some are very into the cards, some are very into the toys, some are into everything, some just like the cartoon show. The idea for the trainers, the fictional kids in the stories, is to catch as many as possible and train them and become very good trainers, which means being good to their Pokemon, but it also means being able to defeat other trainers' Pokemons. There's a combination of the sort of Japanese Bushido concept of being a pure, true warrior with this sort of cockfighting attitude. And the consumer kids can then sort of participate in that by, in a way, catching their own Pokemon, either by catching them in the card or the Game Boy games, or by catching them in a retail context to go out and buy Pokemon toys and Pokemon t-shirts and things.
The storyline, as I follow it, is that there's this 10-year-old boy named Ash Ketchum,
mm-hmm,
who's on a quest to do what? Is he like the ultimate Pokemon collector?
He wants to be the ultimate Pokemon trainer, which would make him, would mean he has one of every single kind of Pokemon, which, like I say, is 150 plus, and will keep growing. They keep adding new ones, so there's no need that they you know, Ash's story never has to end if the market continues for it. And so he leaves home, gets a little bit of training from a guy named Professor Oak, who is the trainer of trainers, And then he goes off very much sort of a quest of the Grail motif, just goes walking off with his friends to catch as many as he can. At this point, he's in the cartoons, which is what most kids are seeing. He's not ultimate yet. In fact, he's very sort of brash and kid-like and makes a lot of mistakes and is easily embarrassed and easily set off. But it's all part of the process of learning how to be a trainer, which I think is much of the appeal for kids, you know, who see themselves kind of learning how to be kids and how to become grown-ups.
And what is a Pikachu?
Oh, Pikachu is he's the monster merchandising success of this thing. He's called an electric mouse Pokemon. He's a little yellow guy with pointy ears. He's the one everybody sees. I think a lot of people just think he's called Pokemon, but he's one of the crowd. And he's cute and adorable, but he's also very irritable. Doesn't like to be stuck in his Pokeball. Doesn't like to be messed with. Basically, doesn't like his tail pulled. Doesn't like to be teased. And he shoots electricity out of his little cheek pockets whenever he's annoyed. So he's Ash's favorite.
Uh-huh. I mean, when I've looked at the cartoon series, it just seems to be this kind of relentless, hit-the-ground-running narrative pursuit of the Pokemon with very little else in the way of plot. Are there underlying themes in the Pokemon adventures? I was reading a New York Times piece that said the cartoon is steeped in traditional Japanese values: responsibility, empathy, cooperation, obedience, respect for elders, humility. Does it strike you this way?
It's got that. Yeah, maybe the episodes you saw, there are some episodes that are very heavy action. There's some that are very sitcom-like. They just put the characters in wacky situations and play those out. Where the traditional values comes in those episodes tend to be the funny ones, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They will set the characters up to be humiliated or annoyed or just otherwise discomfited because they don't do things right. They are disrespectful to an elder or something like that. And then they get their comeuppance, although there's never a particularly heavy, preachy moment in it. But the shows I like when I'm watching it with my kid are either very slapsticky or very sitcom-y. And the all-action ones are kind of a bore to me. But those seem to be the minority. I actually think it's a pretty good kid's cartoon.
Talking to Gerard Jones, who translates Pokemon comics from the Japanese into English, is that a tricky thing to do? How do you go about translating the comic books?
Well, I'm actually half of a team. There's someone who does a literal translation who's better in Japanese than I am. I know a little Japanese, but I'm not fluent. Then I take his literal and his or her, depending on which translator I'm working with, and brush it up into something that works for an American comic book reader. So mm-hmm. I bring some things into the vernacular, and it gets tricky. The Japanese comics people have an irritating love of puns. Visual puns can work, but then some of them, the Japanese have these two different sets of writing, the kanji, which is the Chinese characters, and then the kana, which are the two sets of syllabary writing, you know, the phonetic, essentially. And they'll make puns back and forth. They'll make a pun on the Chinese name of the kanji, which is not the way the Japanese pronounce it. And you get into these really head-busting gags that I basically just have to throw out and make up a new joke that goes with whatever's on the page.
And how many of these have you turned out so far?
Oh, I hadn't stopped to count. I guess I've done about 6 issues of Pokemon Adventures and a couple of Pokemon Magical Journey, which is not out yet, but it's the one aimed at girls, which is, you know, be curious to see how that
I was going to ask you, because it seems to be a very boy thing. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and she sneers at all her boy classmates who are in pursuit of all these Pokemon trading cards.
Hmm.
Is it a very boy thing?
Well, maybe at that's sort of the ultra-latent phase right there at 10. My kid's not quite 7. He's in first grade, and a lot of the girls in his class are into it. So I'm thinking maybe before they go so deep into the gender thing, you know, the girls like it too. Because there's a lot of Pokemons who are very, they're cuddly little animals. They're round, fuzzy little things, and those seem to do really well with, you know, like the preschool and early grade girls. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what Pokemon Magical Journey is focused on, that kind of round-eyed, fuzzy characters. So.
And in the cartoon, there is a girl who accompanies Ash, Misty, is that right?
Misty, yeah, it's the American name, yeah.
Now, there's this fierce competition for the rarer trading cards. Some schools in America have banned the cards because they're distracting kids from schoolwork. I saw a story in the papers about a group of parents who want to file a class action suit under the RICO laws against the companies that manufacture...
Racketeering? That's great.
Yeah, I know. I mean, using the racketeering laws to get cards for your kids because they want to insist that they manufacture the cards in equal number and not create these shortages.
Right.
I mean, it seems very different from... I mean, maybe I'm dating myself from when you used to, you know, collect baseball cards and, you know, waiting and opening up the package to find the rare Roger Maris was part of the fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think a lot of kids still like that, actually. I know a lot of kids who either because it, you know, they're just not interested in spending a bunch of money or their parents won't let them or whatever, actually do follow that sort of gradualist, you know, trading and waiting to see what comes up. It gets crazy when you start to get card shops who will hoard the rare ones and sell them really high. But I think ultimately that shouldn't be a problem if parents just draw the line and say, don't spend $25 on a piece of cardboard. Wait a while and it'll come around.
Yeah, I mean, these cards are in themselves, even the package is pretty expensive. It seems like a rather pricey hobby to get into.
Yeah, I think if you want to do the card, because the card thing is not just collecting, but it's there's also a game, and it's too complex for me to get, or maybe I just haven't put the time in, but kids around 11 or 12 seem to get it very well. It's an actual sort of strategy game, so once you get enough, then you can start to play the game and defeat each other's Pokemon. That, I think, adds to the fever, because then it's not just collecting, you know, in order to get, say, the Roger Maris card, but in order to have a certain strategic advantage in the game, you need certain cards, so it just it makes the kids more rabid. But that is my take on it, at least. That does seem to be a minority of the kids, a pretty small minority. Most of them are just into doing the Game Boy or just collecting the cards, you know, just having them and not sweating too much having all of them, or watching the TV show.
Gerard Jones translates the Japanese Pokemon comic books for their American editions. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Gerard Jones translates Pokemon comics for their American fans. The latest Pokemon thrill opens today. It's called Pokemon the First Movie. One drawback I see to this is that there's nothing to attract parents to this the way Disney has filled a lot of its recent cartoons with, you know, kind of smart-alecky characters that make ironic comments about what's going on so that adults feel as if they're being addressed too.
Yes.
The Pokemon cartoons seem very earnest, very single-minded, and humorous in a very childlike, slapsticky way. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do, and I actually prefer that. I'm kind of a purist on kids' entertainment or age-targeted entertainment. I don't really like this this business American creators have gotten into in the last couple decades of trying to sort of stretch the audience out or stretch the material around the audience by putting in these little self-referential, I kind of think of them as self-eroding references almost. You know, you keep sort of breaking the suspension of disbelief. And I think in a way that's, I think kids are getting bored with that. I don't see any American cartoony creations taking off the way Pokemon is and Sailor Moon did before it. I think this very pure earnestness is actually pretty appealing to kids. They're funny to kids. They're extremely funny to 6, 7, 8-year-old kids because there's a lot of slapstick. There's a lot of people suddenly screaming at each other and their heads get really big and, you know, just wacky stuff with the characters. But there aren't these gags that go over kids' heads and leave the kids feeling like they're being somehow vaguely insulted or they're missing out on something. You know, I like it better myself.
Uh-huh. Is there another trend like this in the offing? It seems as if some of these things, especially when they come from another continent, Japan had Pokemon a couple of years before it hit these shores. Are you aware of anything else that's out there that's, another trend in the making?
Doesn't seem to be a leading candidate right now. No, I've been sort of looking at this stuff at a couple of levels, but Pokemon was getting really big over there when Sailor Moon was going down over there, so you could sort of see that it was going to go from Sailor Moon to Pokemon, you know, in terms of the hot Japanese thing. Or let's say Sailor Moon for the girls and Power Rangers for the boys. That was kind of the dyad back then, and Pokemon sort of took them both. Pokemon's still very, very hot in Japan, so it seems to be holding its own for a while.
Mm-hmm. Sailor Moon was what? It was primarily a team of girls, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a bunch of girls who each was sort of mystically linked to a different planet, and each had different powers, and they would go off in their Sailor Moon, Sailor Venus, Sailor etc. forms. They'd go fight bad guys, and then they would also just disguise themselves as Japanese schoolgirls, and then go through little crushes and peer problems and tests and things like that. So it was one of those double identity stories.
Yeah, see, now maybe it's because I'm a father of daughters. That sounds much more interesting to me, to have a secret identity and then be a sailor superhero somewhere.
Yeah, I like them both. I've been thinking a lot about this stuff because I'm writing this book, Power and Rage, which is about how kids actually use violent stories or action stories in their developmental process in building selfhood. And they both have really significant functions. I mean, there's a real powerful pull to the Ash Ketchum story, where you leave everything and you go off and you truly become an individual and you really shape your own context, and suddenly mom's not there talking to you. And I think every kid yearns for that. Maybe boys yearn for it a little more on the whole, but I know girls do too. And then there's the other side, when as kids realize that they really can't go off and completely remake their own context, that they have to work within a given social world, where the dual identity story gets very appealing. And you can function within your school world, and you can get your A's, and you can make your friends, but then you have a secret life when no one's watching, you know, and there's a sense of self within the social self, real self within the social self, which I think might appeal a little more to girls. Mm-hmm. You know, Superman was always the most popular superhero with girls in a few decades back, and I think that was part of it, because most of his stories used to be about the dual identity.
What's the thesis behind this book you're writing, Power and Rage?
The book's essentially I'm arguing that the so-called violent entertainment, which includes things like Pokemon, things that are not particularly gory but just based on conflict and action, that these things are neither harmful nor just neutral and harmless, but that they're actually useful for kids. Kids are actually working out a lot of their fantasies about empowerment and disempowerment and fear and courage and individuation within these stories. Sort of springing from my own experiences as a superhero fan as a kid, and then following it through the people I've talked to in the business of making comics and cartoons, how most of them, discovered that these stories were very important in their upbringing, and then talking to other kids who, kids now who are using these things, that these can be very healthy influences. They aren't always. They can spin in the wrong direction, but if parents are aware of them and communicative about them, sort of know what their kids are into and why, I think they can really help kids turn video games and cartoons and comic books into very positive forces.
Is one of the ways of doing that is to limit exposure to them, or to discuss the exposure that kids have to them?
I think discussing's good. I think communication's good. I think sort of being aware of what the kid's getting out of it, as opposed to just being freaked out about the fact that the kid is doing play fighting or running around, acting as though he's karate chopping or throwing bombs or shooting. Mm-hmm. To understand that these are aspects of a kid developing a sense of power and developing a sense of potency, and just developing a sense of self as something that can endure even when the world is pushing against it. I don't think limiting exposure is useful unless you have a kid who is clearly having problems breaking away from it. I mean, some kids do become almost addictive with it, and then it might be good just to pulling back a little just to let them get a little more balanced. But I think in general, my tendency is to trust the kid, trust the kid's gut, trust the fantasies of the child until you see a problem, not to be afraid of the fantasies going in.
The values that are expressed in Japanese comics, there's just natural differences in Japanese societal values and American. I wonder how they conflict, how they complement each other in the Pokemon books and the Japanese comics you've worked in.
Well, the conflict is less than maybe it would have been a couple of generations back. It seems like everything is sort of moving together. For example, the way Ash and Misty interact, the boy-girl interaction, is not at all the traditional, you know, sort of warrior-maiden interaction that Japanese entertainment seemed to have. It's very much the two sort of just at the end of latency, you know, the two kids sort of beating up on each other, and you can tell they like each other and hate each other at the same time. And so it's actually a fairly smooth transition. I think one thing is that the Japanese are a little more unapologetic about fictional violence, in that I think American cartoon producers probably would have been a little more squeamish about this idea of capturing wild animals and training them to fight each other. But somehow the Japanese thing just does it so blithely, and it makes the business of catching them so noble and pure that you kind of don't notice it, or you don't stop too much to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the creatures seem awfully happy once they're in the situation. There's a certain way the Japanese physical comedy and then the sort of smart-alecky verbal comedy of American cartoons works really well together, because you can tell there are places where the American translators have slapped different gags on the cartoon, and I do that when I rewrite them. When I polish up the translations, I'll stick in a few extra gags because our audience kind of wants the gags. So it makes them maybe a little funnier, maybe slightly less earnest.
Mm-hmm.
You get the Japanese slapstick, and then you get the sort of wise guy or character-based gags coming from the American end. You know, you got the Meowth, who is the bad guy Pokemon with a kind of a New Jersey accent, and there's some certain little twists that you wouldn't find over there.
Gerard Jones translates the Pokemon comics for their American fans. We'll be back with him in the second half of the show. I'm Ken Tucker, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Pain Free at Your PC by Pete Egoscue, a program of stretches and exercises designed to relieve repetitive stress syndrome. From WGBH Boston, producer of Mystery, airing the Mrs. Bradley Mysteries with host Diana Rigg in the title role, tomorrow night on PBS. And from Crown, publishers of the book Renegades of the Empire, how three software warriors started a revolution behind the walls of Fortress Microsoft, by Michael Drummond. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hey, kids! What time is it?
It's howdy doody time!
Coming up, we remember Lester Bowie, the jazz trumpeter and co-founder of the Art Ensemble of Chicago, who died on Monday. His musical spirit ranged from the avant-garde to doo-wop to this loopy version of the Howdy Doody show theme. And more of our conversation with Gerard Jones on translating Pokemon for American audiences.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. My guest Gerard Jones translates Pokemon comics into English. We've been discussing the differences between Japanese and American comic book appetites. Well, I know also in Japan that there's an enormous adult readership for comics, certainly not of the Pokemon kind, but of comics that can be very mature, that can be very sexually explicit, very violent. I wonder what it is about the culture that makes comics more acceptable and can accommodate those kinds of themes.
Well, the U.S., I think just there's always been a tendency in American culture to distrust things that are not classy enough, that are not upper middle class enough. There's a tendency to sort of want to shake off our own kind of proletarian roots and move up. And comics got caught in that, especially post-World War II. There was just a real tendency towards seeing this kind of thing as trash, and smart people didn't read them. Comic books, that is. Now, comic strips, you know, you had people like Jules Feiffer, who was just, you know, required reading in of 50s, among 50s intellectuals. But comic books were just seen as something sort of tawdry, sort of low class, and therefore were not to be looked at by people of any level of education or income. That doesn't seem to be as big an issue. Enjoying kind of junky pop culture things in all forms and all media in most countries is more acceptable. I think there's less nervousness about proving that they're upwardly mobile. I think this American history is all about trying to rise above something. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain shame about things that we used to read or used to do either as kids or as immigrants or as farmers or as whatever we used to be. But the Japanese seem a little easier with it, so.
And even easier to take it to extremes. I mean, there's a popular Japanese comic, as I understand it, where the hero is called Rape Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is some spooky stuff, especially from our point of view. Again, I think the Japanese are less squeamish about fantasy as fantasy. I think there's a little less of a fear that the fantasied thing will blur into reality or inspire reality. And I think to some extent that's correct. I think there are people who are inspired by pop culture to do bad things, but I think also most of these people probably don't need the inspiration. I think you're dealing with other issues than the pop culture as an influence. And I think a lot of people, and again, I'm not specifically talking about Rape Man here, which I don't really know any more about than the name, but I think there is something to be gained from living these you know, spooky, violent, forbidden fantasies in a fictional context and then coming back to reality with them worked into you in some way, you know, and it's all essentially how you use it as opposed to what it is. Now, in defense of the Japanese, they always get this rap of having the really violent, really explicit comics, and there are some of those, but they also have comics of a maturity and a subtlety that we don't get close to. You know, just stories about people, stories about adults interacting. They might be humor, they might be love stories. They're the so-called salaryman comics that are basically just about working men in the corporate world trying to survive. So they go not only to extremes, but also to just capturing life in a way that that comic books don't hear. I think comic strips often go that way.
Yes, we don't have the American equivalent of Willie Loman in our comic books, I guess.
No, somehow.
When you were growing up and even as an adult, what were the comic book heroes that you liked?
Well, I was my mother didn't like comic books when I was younger, and it was I think I was 13 when I finally was able to get to them. The one who spoke to me at that moment was the Incredible Hulk, who was I was a very nice, mild, civilized boy, who I wasn't very good at asserting my emotionality or my desires, and here was the Hulk, who was nothing but a big bunch of emotionality and desire and fear and rage, stomping around and smashing buildings, and he instantly nailed me. I just, you know, sort of all of my repressed anger and individuality and just desire to shake things off and break through the walls went straight to the Hulk. So
you were,
for a while, he was my guy.
You were mild-mannered Bruce Banner who turned into the Hulk.
Yes, and the gamma ray blast was that first issue. Yeah,
right.
So yeah, he's a fun character. He used to be. Now they've made him, I think, smart, and he just talks like a normal person. And
What's the point?
I don't have any interest. Yeah, I know. Why be a Hulk at that point? What good is it? So,
do you prefer working on Japanese comics to American comics at this point?
Well, it's a whole different thing. When I was doing American comics, I was writing them. I was actually making them up, you know, from scratch or from editorial dictates, whereas the Japanese stuff, I'm polishing a story that's already there. It's sort of two different chunks of my brain. But I have to say, I actually like Japanese comics better just because of the variety of story. The American comics have really gotten locked into just a couple of things, either the superhero thing or then the sort of grown-up, suspensey fantasy horror thing, and there are exceptions, of course, but that's kind of those are the two things that have sort of taken over. So I got tired personally of the superhero story. I see why new kids like it, and you know, I liked it as a kid, but there's a point when you just can't tell that story anymore. It just I've done it all, you know.
Right.
So then suddenly I'm off with the Jigglypuff and Pikachu and all these weird non-talking animals, these little silly, fighting beasts. And it's really refreshing.
Do you have any qualms about associating yourself with this gigantic commercial Nintendo venture to turn every kid in America into a Pokemon fan?
You know, it has never felt like that to me, and maybe I'm glossing over some things, but it really does seem as though this was something that wasn't expected to be a big hit. First of all, when it started in Japan, it was just another Game Boy. It wasn't their big push at the time, I don't think. But the kids glommed onto it. And even over here, it was pretty tentatively released to the U.S. It's a big marketing thing now. But it really feels to me like the kids have made this happen. They glom onto these things. They like these creatures. And the marketing machine is rushing to catch up. My sense of... Maybe now the marketing glut has caught up to the market, but I think for most of 99, it seems as though there just wasn't enough stuff out there for, at least for little kids. Maybe if you were really into the cards, it's different, but having a six-year-old who wanted, like, little plastic toys, there weren't many places to go, and they would sell out, and, he couldn't find the creatures he wanted. So this really does seem to be a case where the kids have this appetite based on discovering the material, and the machine is just running to get there. So it doesn't feel like they're being zombified to me. It feels like the kids are really leading this one. So
yeah, I guess that's true, because Sailor Moon never took off quite the way I think they expected it to in America. And I guess this is an example of, you know, pop culture being led by its audience as opposed to by the manufacturers.
Yeah, I think they really were looking the wrong way. They were still trying to pump life into Power Rangers and Sailor Moon, and this Pokemon thing was just all of a sudden there. I don't think anyone counted on how much kids like cute little animals, and how that, you know, they knew kids like fights, and they were looking at things that had lots of fights, but they forgot that they also like, you know, these little fuzzies, and when the little fuzzies and the fights came together, it just hit them where they live, you know. So,
well, thank you very much, Gerard Jones. I really appreciate you talking to us.
No problem. Thanks.
Pokemon expert Gerard Jones. Pokemon the first movie opens today. By the way, you know you've really entered American pop culture when you get parodied on the TV show South Park. Listen to this.
I just got this sweet Cyborg Bill doll.
Oh, please. Cyborg Bill is so yesterday.
Yeah, like ancient history. Cyborg Bill isn't cool anymore?
No, dude. Cyborg Bill hasn't been cool for a long time, Calf.
Why the hell don't people tell me these things?
It's all Chimpokomon now.
Dude, if you collect Chimpokomon, you can complete the primary main objective. What's the primary main objective?
You don't even know what the primary main objective is?
The primary main objective is to destroy the evil power. Well, what's the evil power?
Oh my God. The identity of the evil power won't be revealed until all Chimpokomon are collected by Royal Crown Chimpokomaster.
What the...
God, get with the times, dude.
Coming up, the Naomi Wolf controversy. This is Fresh Air. The news that Vice President Al Gore had hired feminist writer Naomi Wolf as a high-paid campaign consultant on women's issues has sparked quite an uproar. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan weighs in on the controversy.
Last Thursday afternoon, a very young-sounding staffer from CNBC called my office at school. CNBC wanted to interview me, he said, to get my thoughts on the Naomi Wolf controversy. I laughed and told him that because I hadn't gotten much sleep the night before, my brain had blown a fuse, and anything I'd say about Naomi Wolf would be as fatuous as the things she herself usually says whenever she's on TV. He persisted. We could come to you, film at your office if you're tired. I said a polite no thanks and hung up. Then, just as my ego was inflating, the phone rang again. It was the young and now more desperate-sounding staffer. Can you think of anybody who'd want to say something about Naomi Wolf? Well, it seems like by now everybody else has. So here's my considered soundbite. Naomi Wolf. Yeech. I've reviewed two of Wolf's three books, which is, I guess, why CNBC called me. I thought her first, The Beauty Myth, competently told us readers what we already knew about the social construction of ideas about female beauty. Her most recent book, Promiscuities, set out to analyze sexual behavior in America after the sexual revolution of the 1960s. In it, Wolf wed her own coming-of-age reminiscences to pop anthropology and new-agey nonsense, like proposing that adolescent girls should be taken out into the wilderness and initiated into the mysteries of womanhood. As a culture critic, Wolf is not dumb, as some detractors have called her, but she is a lightweight. She's the perpetual undergraduate with her hand in the air, eager to spout off about rather than to think through a subject. As a feminist, apart from her naughty enthusiasm for masturbation among adolescents as an alternative to intercourse, Wolf is a nice girl. Or as she keeps reminding us in interviews these days, a nice wife and mother. On camera, Wolf smiles tenaciously. She reminds me of the Reese Witherspoon character in the movie Election, determined not to offend, doggedly promoting conventional wisdom, and above all, herself. What's so wrong with that, you might well ask. We Americans like self-promoters. Hooray for Wolf that she pulled in that $15,000 a month consultant's fee. Fair enough. But I think one of the reasons that the grinning Wolf fails to engage even other centrist liberals is that we Americans also like our self-promoters to entertain, to have a twinkle in their eye that lets us know they're aware of their own act. Muhammad Ali had that twinkle. So does Camille Paglia, whose giddy, egocentric riffs on gender issues are eminently preferable to Wolf's self-serving earnestness. Take, for instance, Wolf's defense of that $15,000 a month salary. Wolf doesn't stop at saying, "They offered it to me, I took it, wouldn't you?" Instead, she represents her flax gold as an economic step forward for all women. Images of the other feminists whom Al Gore could have turned to for insight into women's issues keep swimming in my head. If he wanted a fluent issue synthesizer, why not Gloria Steinem, whose history of activism at least gives her some gravitas? Or on the touchy subject of adolescent celibacy, how about Andrea Dworkin, who's long argued, bizarrely but bravely, that intercourse is an instrument of women's oppression? Or how about my own holy trinity of rigorous feminist thinkers, Katha Pollitt, Barbara Ehrenreich, Ellen Willis? You'd never catch any of them breezily comparing stolid Al Gore to the visionary poet William Blake, as Wolf did on a political talk show this past Sunday. It was vintage Wolf, a comparison that illuminated nothing but her own Rhodes Scholar facility in 19th century romantic poetry. I think the most disturbing thing about this whole business is not Naomi Wolf herself, but the fact that any perceived influence on a presidential candidate by a feminist, even such a non-threatening one like Wolf, is seen as alarming. Instead of the Red Scare, we're living through the Fem Scare. In the next millennium, wouldn't it be great to have a presidential candidate who didn't need a consultant on women's issues because they were so ingrained in his or her consciousness? Oh, where have you gone, Eleanor Roosevelt? Your nation turns its lonely eyes to you.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Lester Bowie, an innovative trumpeter who was one of the founders of the Art Ensemble of Chicago, died Monday of complications from liver cancer. He was 58. Bowie was touring with his group Brass Fantasy when he fell ill. In a moment, we'll hear an interview Terry Gross recorded with him 10 years ago. Bowie was both a great jazz scholar and showman, and he had a great enthusiasm for all kinds of music, ranging from avant-garde jazz to R&B and doo-wop.
Start playing rhythm and blues standards with the band?
Well, when I first started playing professionally at age 15, I played with a group called the Continentals that was backing up a lot of doo-wop groups during that time. This is 1954 to 59. And one of the first songs that I learned was The Great Pretender. So assuming that jazz always expounded on contemporary music, I was always confused as to why jazz guys never really picked up on what was happening for the doo-wop guys in the 50s. So to pick up that slack and to fill that space, I decided to do it myself.
Did you ever turn your back on those songs yourself because they weren't jazz and you were a jazz musician?
No, I've always been a professional musician first. I always tell any student that I have that if you want to be a jazz musician, you first have to learn how to feed yourself with the instrument. After that, you can specialize. And another thing, we in jazz aren't supposed to be so closed-minded as to turn our backs on any kind of music.
Did playing with people like Solomon Burke and Jackie Wilson, Rufus Thomas, Gladys Knight, Patti LaBelle give you a sense of the theater of music?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And it taught me a lot about staging and just how music moves and how it affects people.
Did you do steps and wear jackets, and did you have synchronized horn movements?
I did the steps, we wore the jackets, but I didn't like the fast moves. You know, one time I auditioned for James Brown. Actually, I auditioned three times. I never got the gig, but I was always glad I didn't because I didn't want to flip my trumpet around like that. I was scared. That's the only trumpet I had.
Well, you mentioned James Brown. You do Papa's Got a Brand New Bag on your new record. Tell me why you chose that one.
Well, for two reasons. James Brown has been one of the influential people in music since I was in high school, since 1955. And this is just part of our homage and our respect for his music and what he's done for jazz and what it's done for rhythm and blues, what it's done for the rap music of today. He is truly the godfather of soul.
About your playing. You tend to play in the cracks between notes a lot, and you do these flub notes that are perfectly controlled. You know exactly, or you seem to know exactly how you're going to miss a note. And I was wondering how you develop that kind of technique.
Well, I used to tell people I've built a whole career off making mistakes. What I do is, if I make a mistake, I just learn how to do it on purpose. So then I've got the note that I should have hit, then I get the note that I didn't hit, but I know how to make both of them on purpose.
Well, do you think of yourself as having a lot of technique as a player?
Well, I've probably got the most advanced technique in brass as far as the newer elements that I use. I don't have the best by any means as far as the standard trumpet classical technique, but who cares?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever care?
Nope, Fred, not. At the time, my father was a classical musician. Trained as a classical musician in the 30s, and when he came up, there was no hope of a black man ever getting any, being with the symphony orchestra in the States. So I didn't even consider that. It was never part of my, never part of it. Mm-hmm. Plus the music kind of bored me a little bit too.
We were talking before about the theatricality of music and the matching jackets that you'd have to wear when you were playing with rhythm and blues bands and doo-wop groups. You wear a lab coat when you perform with Brass Fantasy. How did you start using that as your stage uniform?
Well, I started using a lot of, I've used a lot of different ones. I've been a priest, I've been a hard hat. But the white jacket kind of stands for research. And I've been a researcher, and this, I consider the stage as my laboratory.
Yours look to me like the mad scientist when you wear it. You know, that you're cooking something up in your laboratory.
Yeah, Jack Sheldon once told me that I was a, was like a psychiatrist gone berserk or something.
Trumpeter Lester Bowie speaking in 1989 with Terry Gross. Bowie died Monday at the age of 58. We'll continue this interview in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with trumpeter Lester Bowie. He was 58 when he passed away on Monday. This interview was recorded in 1989.
Let me change the subject to the Art Ensemble of Chicago. What part of your playing and your personality does that group bring out?
Well, the Art Ensemble is the artistic, the research, the multi-ethnic, influential, heavy. This is the, I believe this is the most difficult music that I play is with the Art Ensemble. I can play things with the Art Ensemble that everyone else wouldn't know what to do, but just hold their eyes open wide. So it's the most advanced musically of all the groups.
Did you think of yourself as being an avant-garde player when you helped form the group in 1965?
No, we didn't. We never considered ourselves avant-garde. I mean, people considered us avant-garde. We've been trying to live that down now for the last 25 years. So it's because avant-garde has a sort of a negative connotation. When people think of avant-garde, it means something that they're going to have difficulty understanding, something that's going to be maybe chaotic and. Avant-garde doesn't really mean that. It means just something that's a little bit ahead of its time. It doesn't necessarily mean it's atonal or it's a bunch of confusing sounds that may be difficult to decipher. So it's kind of hard to live that down, and that label was kind of stuck on us.
Well, the Art Ensemble is really a group that not only plays, you know, challenging music, but they, you know, it's a group that really knows how to have fun, and that is also like Brass Fantasy into theatricality. Most of the members of the Art Ensemble of Chicago wear face paint. For performances. I believe you usually don't.
I sweat too much. I'd have that paint all in my mouth. It'd be all down in my horn, up in my nose. So I don't use it.
Was there ever any pressure on you to do it so that you'd fit in with the way everybody else was?
No, working? There's no pressure to fit in, because if you fit in with the Art Ensemble, you fit out.
Right.
Because it's about being individual, and it's about expressing yourself any way you want to. The whole idea of the paint is the tradition of the mask and the in order to prepare yourself to play music, you try to put yourself on another level. You want to become out of yourself, become the music itself, you know. And to do this, it requires changing something. I don't want to look the same way I look walking down the street as I do when I walk on the stage, because on the stage is when I'm presenting my craft and when I really have to concentrate and get into what I'm doing. And the change of costumes, the paint, all of this helps.
How did you join the art ensemble? Or I should say, how did you co-found it?
Well, what happened is I moved to Chicago. I was married at that time to Fontella Bass, and she got a hit called Rescue Me, and we moved to Chicago. And after playing in the studios and doing the jingles for about a year, I heard about Richard Abrams' experimental band, and I went and sat in with their experimental band. And the next day, I was a member of the ACM, and Roscoe Mitchell and Joseph Jarman and I were all rehearsing together.
It must have seemed like a big leap at the time for you musically?
No, not actually. You have to understand that you don't go from bag to bag in this music. You don't say, well, I'm jazz and I'm R&B. I've always wanted to be a jazz musician. I've never wanted to be anything other than a jazz musician. But I also knew that I may have had to be a country and western musician to survive until I could play jazz for a living. So it all works together. One helps the other. I mean, my R&B experience helps me right now. My jazz experience helps me when I go to India or to Africa to play. You know, if you can play bebop, you can play just about anything. You know all the patterns of just about any music in the world. So I can use my bebop experience to help me play Chinese music. I can use the Chinese experience to help me further enhance or play something new on something else. So it all works together. You don't try to be just, you know, it's not just like one at a time. I'm R&B for a couple of years and I'm into jazz. It all kind of fuses together.
Trumpeter Lester Bowie speaking in 1989 with Terry Gross. Bowie died Monday at the age of 58. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Bob Purdick is our engineer. For Terry Gross, I'm Ken Tucker.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publishers of Walkin' the Dog by Walter Mosley, now in hardcover wherever books are sold. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Cooper's Oak Wine of the Month Club, premium wines delivered to home or office. Month-to-month memberships or 3, 6, or 12-month subscriptions. 800-795-BEER. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the music of Buddy and Julie Miller. Their songs have been recorded by everyone from the Dixie Chicks to Little Jimmy Scott. The Millers will play some of their songs and talk about their adventures in the music business. I'm Ken Tucker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.